100% born in the Appalachian Mountains and made in the USA, Timber Ninja Outdoors provides a range of mobile hunting options to accommodate diverse hunting preferences. Whether you prioritize comfort, lightweight design, or versatility, their two-panel and single-panel saddles collection has something for everyone. The Black Belt Nano is the lightest single-panel saddle available on the market, weighing in under a pound. The saddle is designed with the minimalist hunter in mind, focusing on lightweight functionality and breathability. One notable feature is the patent-pending magnetic stick clip system on the side, which allows for convenient transportation of sticks up the tree, as well as a built-in platform holder. The Nano saddle can be folded up to the size of a Nalgene bottle, enabling easy portability. With a four-way stretch material on the back for a comfortable fit, as well as strategically placed padding for hip pinch relief, you can use code EASTMEETSWEST to get free shipping on any Timber Ninja order. If you try it out and don't like it, send it back within 30 days for a full refund. Learn more at TimberNinjaOutdoors.com and sign up for their email newsletter for exclusive discounts and product drops. Maven makes the highest quality optics at half the price of their competitors through their direct-to-consumer business model. The brand new B7 represents the expansion of their compact lineup and is designed to be more compact and portable than their acclaimed B3 Bino. With a smaller objective lens, the binocular takes a significant leap in terms of size reduction. The B7 is available in both an 8x and 10x option, making it their most compact premium binocular yet. If you're looking for something that will fit in your pocket for deer hunting, turkey hunting, or scouting missions, but still want crystal clear optics, check out the new B7 from Maven. All their optics come with a lifetime, no-fault warranty. If you run it over with your truck or your significant other chucks it at your head, they'll repair or replace it. Use code EASTMEETSWEST-GIFT for a free gift on any full-price optics order at mavenbuilt.com. Better Backstrap's mission is to provide the highest quality seasoning for the meat you work so hard for. They wanted to give hunters another choice besides the big box store brands full of fillers and preservatives. Born right here in Pennsylvania, Better Backstrap Seasonings will turn up the taste of your wild game. Right now, you can pick up their sampler gift box, which includes gun season garlic, tall tine taco, and the original seasoning in a custom gift box. You can use the code EASTMEETSWEST for free shipping at betterbackstrap.com. For all of those that want a truck bed cover for work or play, Diamondback makes the top-of-the-line, heavy-duty covers that help you do more with your truck. They're perfect for the truck-owning, avid sportsmen, outdoor enthusiasts, and weekend project warriors. I'm currently using the HD cover that is capable of holding up to 1,600 pounds on the top, and then I have the Yakima Overhaul HD bars on top so I can put my rooftop tent on it. When I'm not using my rooftop tent and able to use the trifold design of the Diamondback, I have the Crossbin 8 in there to organize all of my stuff in the back of my truck bed. Diamondback is made right here in Phillipsburg, Pennsylvania. If you want to check them out, head over to diamondbackcovers.com.
Are you an adventurer looking to take your hunt to the next level? Then you're in the right place. Welcome to East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic.
Hey everyone, welcome back to another episode of the East Meets West Hunt podcast presented by Spartan Forge. On today's episode, I am joined by Jared Prussia of the Hunter Podcast and Whitetail Properties. We discuss the controversial inner workings of advertising in the hunting industry, purposefully hunting big buck states, Jared's first experience hunting the big woods of Pennsylvania with Steve Shirk, and much more. If you haven't listened to the Hunter Podcast before, those guys, Jeremy and Jared, are great at interviewing, and they really tackle some controversial topics, which I commend them on doing that and not worrying about any of the backlash. They just talk what they think about, and I really enjoy that. So I think you'll like this episode. On this week's Mountain Buck Monday Story of the Week, we have another story coming out of Virginia from Charlie Hage. Charlie wrote in, "I've hunted the National Forest in southwestern Virginia since I was about 12 years old. We do a deer camp every year with my dad and a few friends. This year I had some vacation time saved up, so I took a few weeks off in late October and November. November 16th was the first day of our deer camp, but it was my fourth week straight of hunting Wednesday to Sunday, taking Monday and Tuesday off to work. The rut exhaustion was starting to set in. The plan was everyone was going to load up in the morning and get to camp around midday. I wanted to hunt the morning, so I loaded the truck the night before and headed out at 4 a.m. to make the hour and a half drive to my hunting location. The area I planned on going was only accessible from the Blue Ridge Parkway. When I arrived at the gate, it was locked. I only had about 30 minutes before first light with no idea where I was going to hunt. After contemplating different options for a few minutes, a spot popped up in the back of my mind that I hadn't been to since the 2020 season. I decided to wing it. I backtracked down the mountain and backed up another and arrived at the trailhead right about first light. The spot I was heading to was a small micro bench on the side of a steep slope with laurel thickets on both sides. I took my time getting in. The ground was frozen and crunchy. I arrived at the spot at about 8 a.m. 11 a.m. rolled around and I hadn't seen anything, so I decided to hit the horns together. I remember something that I heard on your podcast from Zach Fehrenbaugh. He was talking about hearing a real buck fight. He was saying how you can't really hear the antlers over the ground noise they're making. That's what I was going to try and do. The noise of brush busting, leaves flying, and rocks rolling down the mountain echoed through the timber. I sat back down and got ready. About 5 minutes later, I caught movement coming out of the laurel thicket about 50 yards away. I caught a glimpse of a large main beam and knew it was a good buck. He was coming straight at me, ready for a fight. I swung my muzzleloader up and rested it on my shooting stick. I put the crosshairs right in the crease between his shoulder and neck and let it rip. I immediately called my dad and friends. Once the initial excitement wore off, it dawned on me, how am I going to get this thing out of here? I couldn't get him out the way I came in. It was too steep. I called my dad and said I was going to debone him and pack him out, but he was adamant that we have this beast of a mountain buck hanging in camp. There was a logging road about a half mile down from where I was that I looped around the mountain, so I elected to drag him to that. From where I hit the logging road to the truck was just over 3 miles with a gradual uphill drag almost the entire way. Luckily, my buddies left right as they got the call and met me on the trail with the sled. It still sucked. We got back to the truck right at dark, a day in the mountains I will never forget. And thank you for everything with the podcast. It has helped me a lot over the last few years. Well, Charlie, that is a pretty awesome story. And I get amazed every week at some of these stories that come in. People willing to go in deep and really work at it to be able to find these deer. I mean, this deer is something special for Virginia and really anywhere. In the fact that, you know, you hunted that many weeks straight, as much time as you could, and going back to work and doing that just shows that, again, hard work and persistence pays off. So congrats again, Charlie. If anybody wants to check out the photos of this deer, head over to East Meets West Hunt on Instagram or East Meets West Outdoors on Facebook and check that out. If you want to send in your Mountain Buck Monday submission, send it via email to bo@eastmeetswesthunt.com. Just a short paragraph or two and some photos along with it. Really appreciate all the submissions that we continue to get that come in and love sharing them on the podcast. So I'm recording this ahead of time, so I'm leaving now for Total Archery Challenge, which by the time this comes out would have already happened in Seven Springs. So I'll have a little update on that. I'm sure I'll be doing some podcasts there. I'll have an update on that next week. And other than that, I just want to say thanks everyone for listening again. And as always, if you would leave a rating and review on the podcast wherever you listen to it. And share it with your friends, family, anybody you think that it could help out or would enjoy it. And so if you find value in it, that's all I ask is be able to share that stuff. Excuse me. I really, really do appreciate it. So, all right. With that being said, I hope everyone has a great rest of your week. We are rolling. Jared Prussia, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks, buddy.
Yeah, it's good to get to talk to you finally. I feel like I've said this with other guests before too, but we've been trying to schedule this for going on 9 or 10 months, it seems like. And then we talk like, and then we'll just kind of forget like, oh, we're supposed to schedule a podcast, go back and forth, and so I'm glad that we were able to link up here kind of in the middle of the week. So
it's funny being on the other side of it, dude, because you know, so with our, you know, Hunter podcast, we. It seems like it should be, you know, it's our priority, right? It's like, well, we're going to schedule, boom, boom, boom. And it's funny to be on the receiving side of the invite. It's like, wow, I've got my schedule and I've got to work around this and that. And so you really do have to make an effort to prioritize it. And, for you, I was happy to do it.
Yeah, no. I appreciate that. And so you have the Hunter podcast, which I've been a guest on now once or twice. I don't remember. I think it was just once, but been a guest on there last fall and got to talk to you guys. And I absolutely love your guys' show. It's the most interactive video podcast out there. And you guys kind of paved the way and even opened my eyes to the world of doing video podcasts and trying to increase the quality of production. So I've really enjoyed that. And then you also work for Whitetail Properties as well. Is that correct?
That's correct. Yeah. I appreciate the kind words on the podcast there too, man. It doesn't really seem like we did anything, too innovative. There was obviously, your Rogans, so there were some other big mainstream influences that were way before us. But in a sense of applying it like to the outdoor industry, it did definitely seem at the time that we started doing it, it was kind of like, dude, why is nobody doing this? Like there seems to be so much of, there was such a stereotypical approach to, like being in the outdoor industry or like being a content producer or like a pro staffer, all these things that like, are essentially dirty words in today's day and age. And we kind of went down that route, for a short period of time, and we can get into that a little bit if you want, but
yeah.
Ultimately, for the sake of Jeremy, my partner, and I's love of hunting and the sanctity that is the hunting season and the freedom that we have during that time, we were just not going to do it. I wasn't going to give up focus in the tree or time or convenience with like just being as deadly as we can be during those 3 or 4 months. And so the podcast was like our opportunity to like default and still like, have a presence, contribute to the industry that we care a lot about, without I think inhibiting us doing what we love, which is to bow hunt whitetail deer, right, and branching out from there. So
yeah, and it's funny you say that, because similarly, that's a reason why, like, I've done some hunting films and some of filming hunts, but I make sure that that's not a priority and that's not what I want to put out there, because for me it does take away a little bit from that experience in the hunting of like doing the traditional route of filming hunts and putting out, that type of content, where like the podcast allows me to make it feel like you're hanging out with buddies, talking about information, be able to, have helpful information, hopefully, for the people listening, and be able to do that based off of the experiences you have while you're out in the field.
Sure.
Yeah. Sure. And How long have you been, how long have you guys been doing, you and Jeremy, you've been doing the podcast now?
I want to say we've elapsed 2 years of, consistent one a week. We've had a few, we have kind of a sub series, the I Bought a Farm series, and there's been a couple weeks where we did doubles. I think we've put out like 130 or so episodes, which, compared to, the library that you look at, like I mentioned earlier, like a Rogan or somebody who's done thousands of podcasts, it's just, dude, it's hard to conceive. But the reality is, let's say we did 130 of them at an hour and a half on average, maybe 2 hours a piece. That's like 245, 260 hours that Jeremy and I sat at that table and talked about deer hunting, or related topics and stuff. And it never gets old. It's funny, and my wife would make fun of me if she was here, because she knows I just like to yap and to talk, and like I'm a people person, right? And it plays into our podcast and our real estate business, and it never gets old, dude. I could sit there and just talk about like the nuances of deer hunting and everything that relates to it, like forever. If I could do it every day, if I could do two a day, like we probably would. It's just we have other. Other businesses to run and, family commitments, things to actually do, but, we love it. So.
Yeah. And I've also liked the different approach that you have, like with your podcast is very distinguishable from the standpoint of like, you're not afraid to kind of tackle whatever topics. Like, I feel like a lot of podcasts steer away from controversial things or things that are, you know, kind of like, should we talk about that or not? And you guys are just kind of like an open book as far as like just talking about all those things, giving your opinion, whether people agree with them or not. I think where the value comes is like you're being honest and giving that transparency and that to be able to talk about some of those hard things. And in my opinion, that was what makes it entertaining and great, like to be able to have it and have an actual impact.
Yeah. I mean, that's like the secret. If there was a secret sauce, it's just, be transparent. Because the industry is so full of like non-transparency, right? I think it's like over, you know, and since background on me is like not to go too far back, but so Jeremy Flynn, who is my partner on the podcast now and also my business partner in Whitetail Properties, was my boss for about 7 or 8 years at a company called Stone Road Media. And he hired me right out of college, kind of through some mutual connections. It was actually Bill Winky was the mutual connection via an internship that I had applied for. And So I worked for Jeremy in the outdoor space doing like hunting and fishing, shooting, digital marketing. And you know, I kind of rose to a role of, the VP of marketing for his company. We had, I think at the most, we had probably 15 or 20 employees with, 30 or 35, big clients that a lot of people would recognize. Some of which are obviously still friends and partners of ours today through our current endeavors. But, through that experience, working with Jeremy in the industry and just, kind of seeing, behind the curtain, so to speak, of like how all of these relationships happen in forms of sponsorships of like monies that get exchanged to and from, manufacturers essentially who are your, those are the sponsors. Those are people that control the marketing budgets to content producers or, pro staff members, whatever it is. It's just, man, there's just like a lot of, the way I saw it was kind of like, sacrifice is not the word, but, willingness to promote, products that maybe aren't necessarily your first choice. So, and it doesn't mean that they're bad products, right? But it's just the chances of you having a favorite thing, like say, let's say Hoyt Bowes is a partner of ours, right? Today with the podcast, and there's only a handful of like really notable bow companies, so I guess the odds are greater. But like, what are the chances that we would have a favorite bow, a favorite setup, something we really believe in, a company that think is doing it right, all these things that make us want to be a part or have some kind of partnership with them. What are the chances of a company like that wanting to partner with us, amongst all of the people out there asking for sponsorship dollars? I mean, there must be thousands of people who write, Hoyt Marketing, asking for some sort of free product or discounts or partnerships. So like just the chances of aligning. So and take that example and apply it to every other avenue of like a potential sponsorship income, right? Releases, arrows, camo, blinds, tree stands, like, boots, the list goes on. You could cover every single category where you could potentially bring money in via sponsorship, and think about the chances of those top tier companies, like the ones that you really believe in and have, maybe you're using their products already, the chance that they would want to also partner with you and you would strike a successful partnership. It's like, man, yeah. I think we're pretty lucky just to have Hoyt, like one of what, however many, 10 or 15 different, categories that we use. So I think that, just kind of seeing behind the curtain and seeing so many guys in our positions who, not necessarily to any fault of their own, felt forced or like, they're running a business at the end of the day, ultimately took on sponsors and pushed products that like we all know are, are shit and they do too. Right. And it's just, I really got a distaste for that, through my time in the industry. And I've since left that company, working for Jeremy, so that he and I could start, our Whitetail Properties business together. And don't get me wrong, there's lots of great people and great partnerships that happen in the outdoor industry. but it's a small fraction compared to, you know, those people who are out there pushing products just because.
Yeah, you know, it's funny, and I don't think I've talked about it on here at all before, but like, it's been something that from the very beginning, I like good gear, and I like gear that I know is going to work. And like, I've put it to I've made it a point, even when now that I do this as a full-time living, of making sure that like my priorities come first before, you know, the money side of it. And that's hard. Like, don't get me wrong. Like, that's extremely, extremely hard. For example, this is what I was going to give an example of. I think it was like 2 years ago, I had been reached out to by Mountain Dew and about doing a partnership. And they were like, they wanted like two social media posts and some other things. And they're like, what would your rate be for that? And they asked me, and I was like kind of joking about it. And I just sent them back like an extremely, extremely high number, and they accepted it. And I was like, whoa. And at that point I was like, obviously I wasn't going to take it because it was something that I believe in, like fitness and healthy living, like definitely not the right fit. But I was like, and then I saw a lot of other people take that, like that route. So for two social media posts, I believe it was like, I don't know if I'm allowed to say it, but I'll say it anyways. It was like $6,500 for two posts.
Okay.
But for like
a week or two posts, like
in totality. Yeah. Okay. Like,
I mean, dude, what happens is like, you know, they get a marketing budget, like they have a quarterly marketing budget.
Yeah.
Say, hey, you know, intern ABC, go out and align ourselves with, you know, content producers, ABC, in X Industries, and go out and just, you know, spend this budget, right? And they don't know. They're coming from a mainstream, especially like Mountain Dew. You know, they're ready to spend $6,000. That's nothing. They're like,
that's nothing. Like, yeah, to me, I was like, that was a big deal.
There's a podcast out there somewhere where Mountain Dew's social media intern is like, yeah, this idiot was going to do it for $6,000.
Yeah, I know. And that's, but it was just like, and especially at that time, like my platforms are smaller and everything. And it was like, okay, that's a lot of money.
Yeah.
And like, I was like trying to make the transition, and I had to have that thought with myself of like, okay, like this is one of those hard things that are going to come up where you could take easy money, but what you lose is that trust in the people that are listening to you when you talk about gear and do whatever. And for me, I've been very, very lucky that I've been able to work with the companies that I want to work with. And there's been some that have dropped off because they wanted me to use a certain product in their line. I like their other products, but they wanted this one. And I said no, and it ended up resolving the partnership, and that's okay. You know, that's what it is. I'm not going to lie and say like, I want to use this product because I think it's the best thing in the world, when it's really, in my opinion, it at least doesn't work for me, or I don't want it to work for me. And that's just the nature of the beast.
Well, dude, and it gets to a point here where it's like, it's almost impossible. Like, you know, look back 10, 15 years ago, it was doable because, you know, these companies were individually owned, and they only had like one product category that they were really good at. Like QAD had Dropaway, and they still, they might've been bought by somebody, but like whoever, I'm just using an example, like this boot company made boots and they wanted to sponsor you so that you would wear their boots.
Yeah.
Now it's like the entire industry is owned by like a, you know, giant conglomerates that have like at least 5, 10, 15, in some cases 30 or 40 brands like in their portfolio. And if they're sponsoring you on one, like they, you know, they want you to, you know, to cover X, Y, Z. And it's just like, dude, how could you ever, first of all, from a content producer standpoint, like all of your eggs are in one basket in that case, which is financially risky.
Yeah.
But also it just makes it tough to say no, because it's like, well, are they going to cut my sponsorships for these other three brands if I don't want to do this other one that I'm not necessarily a fan of? And yeah. It's a weird landscape right now. And it has been for the past couple of years, as far as like, you know, somebody trying to run a business in the content production space within the outdoor industry. It's weird. You know, to shine the light, like on our side of things, we do have some partners. Like I mentioned, you know, Hoyt is a partner of us. They pay us a little bit of money and they send us bows. And like, we're fortunate to be able to accept that, because like we were already shooting those bows. We really believe in that brand. We really like that company. From a business standpoint, like we see some opportunities to help them and align ourselves with them. you know, and we have a few other partners as well that, really the primary contingency on accepting those is that, we just do what we want. Like, we're not gonna change our conversation in the podcast. We're not going to do specific mentions. Like, you know, we have some commercials on our podcast just, you know, to guarantee them some placement. But really, you know, Jeremy and I's motive for doing the podcast is not to make money. While it would be nice to, and it does for the time being, you know, it's financially sustainable, right? We can pay Nick, our producer, to, you know, sit with us and produce the podcast. And like, I don't know, we can buy some tags every once in a while. Like it's, but it's not much, you know, compared to our primary businesses. So we really enjoy that freedom of free speech, right? That is what makes the podcast successful, in my opinion.
Yeah. And one thing, like, I know that the way I've tried to structure it is, like, podcast ads, people are used to having ads come in. So if it's a company I want to work with and they come to an ad, like a hard sell of an ad, like that's a specific ad, is, in my opinion, acceptable. Like when I watch, you know, if I'm watching Netflix or I'm watching Hulu, whatever, that, and there's an ad that comes up, I expect there to be an ad there. And that's the way that it is. And I'm expecting to be sold on something, you know, but in conversation, like you and I are having right here, pushing, like trying to change the conversation to be around something specific, forcing it doesn't feel right. And I've been lucky that, you know, the companies that I work with don't ask for that. You know, it's like, if you're talking about, say, for example, if you're talking about bows and yeah, obviously that I'm shooting a prime bow, then that's going to be mentioned, but it's not going to be like this forceful thing where I'm going to make up this big story about, you know, that I went in and you know, I went into the bow shop every single year and I shot every single bow that was there. And this one was just so much faster and so much, and just like create this story around it. It's like, I use this bow back in the day in 2017 when I worked at an archery shop. I shot all the bows. I liked this one. I've liked the brand and I've continued to use it since. I like the people behind it. And like, it's a more organic story to it versus just like forcing.
Well, it's truthful. Yeah, it's truthful. Yeah. Like, it's not a hard sell. And I understand what you're saying, like the difference between a commercial and like organic conversation. Like, do people know?
Yeah.
And as fun, as like straightforward as that sounds, like that's where we're coming from. Like, you know, all the TV shows not long ago was less, you know, and maybe Hoyt even was a part of that, but like all these other brands at one time, you didn't shoot with your bow. I shot it with my Hoyt and my Scentlock and my, you know, my whatever, you know, you run down the list. It's like, they didn't even call it by what the thing was. Like, they were just trying to assign it by the name brand.
Yeah.
And, yeah, I don't like that. It became the main thing. That's all people were doing was selling people on. I mean, dude, there's entire shows that exist to promote specific brands. Like that's the sole point of it. And everything gets tied back to it. Dude, the Black Rack is a great, and I don't know those guys at all. Probably great guys. Obviously good deer hunters. They kill a lot of stuff. I can't remember what the name of the show is, but Moon Guide, another one. I think there's a show like about them. You know, it's like these shows, and I understand why they did it. It's like the whole, it was an extension of the business to like, hey, let's produce content to promote this product. And it is what it is. So, I mean, I don't, it's not like they're trying to be something that or hide that fact necessarily.
Yeah.
It's just like, dude, the entire point of that show is to promote this product, period. You know, and it's like, oh, with the Black Rack, I did this with my grunt extinguisher thing. And then that company starts coming out with more products. Oh, I have the phase, whatever, you know. And I'm not saying even that stuff doesn't work. It very well might.
Yeah.
You know, that style of marketing is just like, I don't think it's necessarily good for the industry. I don't think it's a truthful organic approach, you know, from an unbiased opinion. You know, as long as you can know it when you see it.
Yeah, and yeah, you're 100%. But I think like our generation is different than like the, you know, even the generation before us and everything, as far as like how they accepted, you know, marketing.
Yeah,
how like, we don't. Yeah, we don't want that stuff to be shoved down our throats in a way that's like obvious that, okay, this person is, you know, just drinking Mountain Dew and like they're not traditionally doing that in a tree stand all the time. Maybe they are, but you know what I mean? Like there's like certain things that just feel super forced. Yeah. Whereas like, I don't know, I'm not saying that I'm like this perfect human and my philosophy is correct, because it's definitely not, but it's like, I've just looked at it, it's like, what do I use to make my job easier or better? And I would like to align with those companies because like I do make an income from this. So like there has to be some sort of a business aspect to it. And yeah, I mean, I envy like, you know, you guys, as far as like with your podcast, you have this platform, you know, where you have the free speech and you're able to talk about whatever and don't rely on that income, because I mean, that podcast is also, I'm sure, helping you drive business to your other business, you know, with Whitetail Properties.
Sure.
And
for sure.
And being able to utilize that. And I think that's a great way of being able to do it. And there's not like, it's very rare when I listen to your guys' show that it's like, you aren't saying like, you know, come check me out, Whitetail Properties, but it's known that you work for Whitetail Properties, and it's known from the conversations that you're knowledgeable about properties, about deer hunting. You talk to a lot of successful people. Like, it's just, it's a very natural flow of helping the businesses out.
The Spartan Forge app utilizes years of military background and machine learning to pull from millions of data points to accurately predict deer movement, with over 30 years of GPS collar data, trail camera data, academic and state research. The app is a complete tool for planning your hunt with incredible aerial imagery, mapping, journaling, and some of the most accurate and detailed weather data. The latest update is huge. One feature that I'm using a lot during the rut is LiDAR. LiDAR basically removes the trees from the landscape and allows you to see every nook and cranny, logging road, boulder, etc., with some areas having 1 meter data, which just means that you can see any deviation in the land as small as 3 feet. During the rut, I will look for logging trails that intersect with key terrain features such as ditches or draws to funnel deer movement. Use the code EASTMEETSWEST to save 20%. And if you're still on the fence, give the 14-day free trial a chance at SpartanForge.ai. CVA has been America's number one selling muzzleloader brand for over a decade. Hunting with a muzzleloader opens up a ton of hunting opportunities across the U.S., and I've been using the Acura series. But they don't only make badass muzzleloaders. Their line of centerfire rifles are great quality and not terrible on the wallet. The Cascade Short Barrel is ideal for tight quarters, deer drives, and for quick shots in the big woods. You can check out their line of muzzleloaders, rifles, and accessories for every season and every range at bpioutdoors.com/CVA. If you use the code EASTMEETSWEST10, you'll get 10% off of all CVA products, which includes rifles, muzzleloaders, and accessories.
Yeah, well, dude, if I'm being honest, like there's zero thought that goes into it. Like, you know, and I know we've had you on at least one time, if not a couple times, but like I've had people ask me for like, what do you want to talk about? And I'm like, no, like if we try to think about it beforehand, like it'll ruin it. I just want to like, for people we've never talked to you before, it's just like, hey, I just want to get to know you and allow people to experience that conversation as organically as possible. I know we have shared mutual interests, at least in the form of deer hunting, and probably some more will, you know, unveil themselves throughout the conversation. But that's it. There's no like, hey, I want to make sure that we cover, you know, unless they have a very specific study that like they're notable for and or whatever. But yeah, there's no pre-planning that goes into it. It's a free flowing conversation, and we don't edit it. I mean, is the thing, they're not live, but like, and dude, we've caught some flack for one dude, probably, you know, half of your listeners, if not more, to be like, oh, that's the guy from, you know, the Eberhardt podcast, or that, you know, that Higgins got pissed off about. It's funny. Like when I watch our analytics, cause you know, all of our podcasts are on YouTube, so people aren't necessarily just watching the most recent one to watch, you know, ones that have happened in the past. So we have like some highest viewed podcasts. And strangely enough, I think it's so funny, I think that John Eberhardt podcast is one of them, because somebody got upset about what he said about, I think, private land hunters. And he named a few of them specifically. It was like, he ran down through a list. He's like, Don Higgins, Andre DeQuisto, whoever. There's somebody, you know, just your classic, yeah, private land guys, you know? And because John's like, I don't know if he's public land only, but he's permission only, and he doesn't do, I don't think he does any like land management stuff. It's just not his thing at all. Like,
Yeah.
You know, dude, you and I are the age that like our uncles were that guy, you know, that it was just like, hey, I used to be able to hunt everywhere. There were no property lines. There was no food plots, there was no baiting. It was just, you know, we got permission to hunt and we killed the biggest buck that we could. And the guys that were doing it with bows were like legends, right? Like my uncle killed a 160 some inch, you know, 3-year-old with his bow up in Crawford County, Pennsylvania, in the, I don't know, 80s or 90s.
And, oh, really?
80s or 90s. And he was like a legend. Like it might've been in a newspaper, you know? But anyways, so anyways, that Eva Hart podcast is like Coughlin. And then Higgins was like, oh, well, you know, the Hunter Podcast guys, you know, are talking shit on us. And I was like, obviously we weren't, like, you know, it's just a conversation. And we've had Don on as well. But I forget what the main point of that story was, but I think it's funny how people cling to certain stuff like that.
Yeah. But like about the not editing part is what you're getting at. And you just leave it all in there.
Well, and dude, that one, honestly, it's not even like I watch it. We don't watch them back before we publish them. Nick watches it and he publishes it and, it was funny. So afterwards, I don't typically read the comments either. It just, it is what it is. It's out there and it's fine. But some people texted me directly and they were like, dude, you should probably do some damage control on this one. And I was like, for what? Like, what do you mean? And I watched the podcast back and I was like, seemed pretty straightforward to me. Like, you know, I didn't find it extremely offensive. I thought we had a perfectly fair conversation. And, the truth is, probably most of the people that were offended by it didn't watch it either. You know, they kind of heard from somebody and they got the gist and they're like, oh, well, I'm on Don's side or I'm on,
John's side.
Right. And so people choose sides and it's like, it's just so dumb. It's like, we're trying to have a conversation with anybody and everybody. And like, truthfully, since then, you know, we've extended some invitations to come back on and it's like, you know, people get hurt feelings and their butt hurt and,
well, and I mean, it doesn't help with like the
egos, man. They're just such huge egos and these guys are running businesses and it's like, I get it, man. Like, yeah, you know, you have to present yourself as the best deer hunter in the world and that's how you make myself. I mean,
yeah, no, you're spot on. And John Eberhart, I've had him on here before and I've spent time around John at shows and stuff.
He's great. And dude, both of those guys have admirable qualities. And John will be the first to admit to you, like he's an ornery old son of a bitch. Like, and he'll speak his mind and he'll at the same breath go back, well, yeah, you know, you're probably right. I was wrong. You're fine. That's right. You know? Yeah.
And he doesn't, the one thing I really, really appreciate about John is that you'll never hear something come out of his mouth that he doesn't think or believe. Like, he's a straight shooter. Whatever he thinks, whether you agree with it or not, you have to admire the fact that he just says whatever's on his mind at all times.
Yeah. I've pressed him a few times on the scent lock thing. You know, and I respectfully don't believe that it's possible. Like, you know, but I think it's one of those, and he might, dude. He'll take it to his grave. I'll give him that. You know, he's got, you know, novels like whatever, 24-page documents of like how to treat scent lock and how it is the superior garment and how the, you know, the whatever the technology is in there. Like, he 100% believes that he does not get smelled by deer anymore, and that's fine. You know, more power to him. Like, I can't believe it. I don't think it's true. But you know, that's fine. We disagree, like, you know, respectfully disagree. And it's not like, you know, that has to be the end of the friendship or the relationship. Right.
Yeah, no, you're spot on. But what the other thing, point I was going to make on that is it doesn't help with things like TikTok and Instagram where you have a short 60-second clip that goes out and nobody ever looks to the behind the scenes of it. And a lot of the times the point of those clips is to give a piece of information that makes somebody want to listen to the full length episode,
right,
or watch it. Like, that's the point of it. But I've seen it. Like, there was a last year I did a podcast with Chris B and we were talking about archery stuff. And Chris said, Chris is also he believes in his ways of things and he's has the knowledge and success to back it up, you know, but he was big on, like, he thinks people worry too much about FOC, you know, with arrows. And, he put a point in there and I cut it up into a clip that said,
where he all up in arms about that. If you mention broadheads or like, you know, these couple things, it's just like, your left or your right. And it's just like people will go to their graves with it. It's crazy.
Yeah. And he had said that he's like, all he said was, I don't think FOC is as important as people make it out to be when they should be focusing on practicing and being a better shot. And there, he's like, he was basically saying in the rank of things, he has it lower, not saying like it doesn't matter at all or whatever. And oh my gosh, it was like, that video is still blowing up on my YouTube as far as getting traction. It was a short from like last year and like on TikTok, and it was just blowing up and people were just, you know, commenting all these things on it and not understanding the whole conversation.
Ours was the crossbow one. I think Ben Rising made a comment about like, one that honestly we were in support of was, you know, he made a comment about, you know, his view on crossbows and how they, you know, how a season should be treated for them. And basically was to the effect that like, hey, it's, you know, there's a time and place. It's for, you know, disabled, elderly, new hunters type of a deal, but not in, in the primary archery season. And, I mean, dude, you look at, I think it was the state of Ohio, like 70%+ of their archery harvest is crossbow hunters. You know, it's, we're a minority at this point, you know. And that's fine. It's not like it's us and them. It's just, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, I think it's perfectly okay to have opinions on how those technologies should be incorporated into different seasons, because they're clearly different weapons, as is a rifle and so on and so forth. And people did not like that, which is fine. I mean, you know, it's I'm not like, you know, and it stems from like, you know, it's not our primary business. So it's not like, in the sense that like this is our main source of revenue, is how I feed my family. So it's fun for us to like, it's fun to stir the pot, right? Like you want to have, I want that thing to kind of come out. I want people to have conversations about, you know, those hard things. You know, we talk a lot about baiting and still about crossbows and about, you know, different legislation that's proposed. That's kind of a central theme to our podcast, because it affects the future of hunting. Which, you know, obviously we care a lot about. And so I think, regardless of what side you're on, you know, it's important to have those conversations. And like, you're right, that's a downfall of TikTok and Instagram, the short form clips, is that like, it's like reading a book title. You can't necessarily get, all the context of a 2-hour conversation out of a, you know, a 30 or 60 second, clip. So, but that's just is what it is.
Yeah. And the thing is, like, I think people put too much weight on what people say, or like, you know, judge them as a person. And like, you know, for example, you and I, we're humans. We're going to say stupid shit sometimes.
All the time.
Like that is just that is the nature of it.
Stupid shit. Yeah.
And sometimes, you know, sometimes things come to my head and I just say it without thinking enough about it. And that's the way that it is. It's the way that it is. And like, I think that makes it feel more like, I mean, when I'm at deer camp and I'm sitting around there, my family members, my friends that are there, I can probably count 20 times in one night I'll hear something somebody says that I think is stupid. You know, like that's just the way, because we all have opinions on things. Yeah. It doesn't mean I don't like them.
Especially in a hunting camp, like, oh, yeah. Think about how many times, you know, your dad or whoever's been like, oh, you know. Yeah, dude, the list is on end. Yeah. That may not stupid, but just things that I disagree with, right? Like hunting.
Yeah.
It's not science, it's an art, and it's a strategy, and everybody does it a different way. So it's like, it's hard to get along with people when you're sharing a woods together, you know, especially.
Yeah, no, it most definitely is. But I think it's still, like you said, is important to bring up those hard topics, and your mind might shift on things. And I know my mind shifts on things over time as I get more information, you know, I don't always have, you know, all the information if I'm talking about something. And it doesn't mean like, you're like, oh, you should know everything before you talk about it. Nobody does. Like, I'm not sitting there telling you like, this is how to do something and this is the only way because this is 100% right. No, this is just where, at my point in my life and based on my experiences, this is where I believe this works, for example. Yep. And that's how I look at it. And I take that with a grain of salt with anybody and any information that you're getting. And I think if you're not changing through time, then that's more of a problem than just like, you know, digging your heels in the dirt and just being like, this is right because I said this 15 years ago.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, dude, on a, like a sentence to sentence basis, like you have to be totally open to, you know, I think like, you know, narcissism is one of the greatest like traps, like, you know, or preventers of growth in a human being. It's just like, if you're never wrong, then you're never learning, you're never growing. And so I don't necessarily know where mine came from, if it, whatever, just throughout my experiences, like I've become like just the opposite. Like I'm the first to admit, even before I say something, like, hey, I'm probably wrong about this, but I'm going to propose the idea so we can at least discuss it. And that happens all the time. I mean, that's one of my favorite things about our podcast and the conversations that we have, is that I can go into them having already, wiped my hands from having to be the expert on something. Like, I'm going to be the guy that asks stupid questions, because like I want to know, and I know there's people in our audience that like are want to know also, but like people are afraid to ask the question and stuff. And so there's been all kind of topics that like I thought something. I'm like, well, you know, whatever it is, I feel this way about something, and then somebody would propose how that might affect something else that I hadn't considered. It happens all the time. Like, I don't know even close to everything, right? And so it's like I'm excited when somebody proposes something else, and I'm like forced to question my own belief about that. But at the same time, you can't just believe everybody, because everybody's wrong about a lot of stuff. Like, I mean, look at the world that we live in. Like, I just can't believe how blindly people will follow politics, our government, like, you know, leaders. Like, look how frequently people are wrong. Everybody has been wrong. You know, look at whatever, dude. I mean, medicine, politics, literally every single thing that's ever been like decided on has been wrong at some point. Like, you know, we look back and we're like, oh, whatever. Like, we shouldn't have been putting this shampoo on our babies. We found, you know, causes cancer, and like all this stuff. It's like, dude, people are wrong all the time, even and especially experts under pressure to give an answer. And so, you know, while I think you need to, you know, be open to being wrong, you also need to realize that everybody could be wrong.
Yeah.
Question everything.
Yeah.
And
that's what's cool about being able to do like the podcast and stuff. Like, you know, I've grown up hunting in Pennsylvania my entire life, and I've had a style of hunting that I've believed in because I've learned it from my dad and my family that's been successful. But by doing this podcast, I've opened my mind to so many different styles and thoughts and ways of looking at sign differently, and it's helped make me better. Do I take everything? So if I asked you about like your specific hunting strategy for an area, do I take 100% of what Jared does and apply it to my situation and switch? No. But if I can take 2% of that and apply it and it helps, it's like, and it's the same thing with taking in any information. Like, if you can get something from it, you know, I read a lot of books, but I don't like take something, say, for example, Tim Ferriss says, and follow it rule by rule through every single step. I might take one piece out of that and apply it to my own situation that makes sense.
Yeah. Yeah. Question everything. And yeah, I mean, dude, that's what, you know, that's how you get better. It's like you learn from, and the main thing too, man, is like make an assessment of people. Like, I think people just will follow blindly, like, you know, people they've never met and people that are, you know, in our industry, whatever, people who put out a show about how to do X, Y, Z. And it's like, you know, I can look at that as with some personal experience and say, wrong, no, not how I would do it. And so I think as you're opening yourself up to criticism and like learning from other people, like you should vet them, right? You should, you know, ask yourself, like, is that somebody that I want to be like, or that I, you know, in any, you know, facet, if it's deer hunting, if somebody that's like, it should be a successful deer hunter, it'd be somebody that like has done things that you would aspire to, you know, to also do, you know, don't just like, you know, anybody and everybody. It's like, oh, this guy said that, I should do, some guy made a comment on my Facebook page, I should do that. Like, no, you know?
Yeah, no, you're spot on. It's like, you know, like, for example, me and you, we hunt a lot of different places for the most part. It's like, you know, taking something that I say from hunting in the big woods and applying it to an area that you hunt as like the rule is not probably the best option. You know, it's like finding people, like when you're looking for information, I guess what I'm saying is that kind of fit, like you said, like fit your style or what you want to do or the type of areas you hunt. And because there is so much information out there, anybody can click upload, anybody can use their iPhone and do a video and sound smart in it. It's like, and it's not saying that everybody's, you know, full of shit, but at the same time,
that's the censorship conversation.
Yeah.
And it's a double-edged sword because it's like, man, I'm 100% an advocate of complete, you know, freedom of voice. Like anybody, I think anybody should be able to upload. And there's parameters, yes. Like you get into extreme, like pornography with kids on certain platforms. Like I get it.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you're going to limit free speech in any way, shape, or form, you're acknowledging that like somebody is an authority in some degree to be able to vet whatever's being put out there. And it's just like, you know, to my point earlier, it's like, who do you trust to make that decision?
Yeah. Yeah. Who is the one that's going to say this is an authorized authority, you know, this is an authority in this space that deserves to be able to have that. And
look at where we are, dude. I'm sorry to cut you off. Like in a post-COVID era, like, has there ever been a greater example of like the leading authority on like, you know, health in the United States? You know, look at where we are. Right. Yeah. And it's like they couldn't have been more wrong. And not that there weren't some right decisions that were made along the way, but it's like, you know, dude, if you're not like, if your mind isn't open up to like think for yourself in today's day and age, like on that big scale and also like in a scale, like you said, just going into the woods, it's like you're missing something.
Yeah. No, I totally agree. But kind of shifting gears a little bit here, I kind of skipped over kind of your background. We talked about a little bit as far as business, but you know, you're from Pennsylvania, which is kind of how we linked up at first when our mutual friends, Ali DeAndrea and Nick Berger came to me and were like, you need to meet these guys.
Dude, is that how?
Podcast. Yeah. They were
we had Nick and Ali on a podcast in person for 4 hours, 2 days ago. It's dropping.
Oh, really?
Dropping tonight, I think. Yeah.
Oh, no way. That's
Florida. So we crushed a whole bottle of like Whistle Pig or something.
That sounds about right. They're such great people too. Like,
yeah, they are.
I love them. They every at least once a year, they'll either come to my house or I go to their camp and like we just have a night where we drink, make some good food and just hang out and have a good time. Last year, Allie and Nick came to my house and I had killed a bear in Montana. So she's very good at cooking stuff. So she like cooked up these bear tacos and we had a bunch of good food and whiskey and a whole bunch of other stuff.
Then she wrote a whole cookbook. She's published, you know, she's getting ready to release it here, like later in the summer. It'll be like Barnes and Nobles, you know, any, like a publisher picked it up. So she's got a real cooking book coming out.
I know. And I'm so pumped about that. Yeah. People like me need help with that.
She said it openly on our podcast the other day. So I don't think it's a secret anymore, but.
Yeah, I knew. Yeah, they had told me about it like, I don't know, a while back that it was going to happen. I just wasn't sure when it was coming out. So that's awesome.
Yeah.
But anyways, they were the ones that like said, you know, I need to meet you. You know, they were just like, Allie was like, I've met a bunch of different people and I just feel like you guys would get along well. And, you know, I think it would be a cool conversation. And I believe that's how somehow... I don't know if that actually led to us meeting or if you guys had just reached out to me, either you or Jeremy, I don't remember. And it just happened to be that way. But anyways, you're Pennsylvania boys too. So I wanted to kind of hear your background, like as a kind of a hunter and like where that's taking you now.
I don't know if you're going to love the end result of it. As far as, you know, where I choose to hunt and stuff. Now I've kind of like, I don't know if the word is high graded or like, I've just really, you know, I know what I want out of a whitetail hunting experience. And like, I've been fortunate to have some opportunities to do it out of state. And I choose to do that quite a bit now in today's day and age, but, you're right. I was born in Rochester, New York. And, just for whatever reason, my dad had a job up there at the time and, but moved back here when I was like 3 years old. So I've lived here my entire life. And, I mentioned, so as far as like my deer hunting influence, I guess, I don't know, man, it's probably very similar to yours or, you know, a lot of like Pennsylvania guys is like, my dad had a had a bow, and I can't remember what it was. It was just one of those old, like, it seemed like they were all the same back then. I don't even know what the brand was. You know, no big cams or anything like that, just a bow, right? And they were shooting aluminum shafts, and he had been somewhat of a trapper too. So like we always had, I can remember growing up, you know, we always had like, there was like 40 or so, like Hanabear muskrat traps, like hanging from our basement down there. And he had some, like some ones and a half, like he was a muskrat trapper, you know, when he was in high school and college and stuff. And so we had that stuff around, and like in my, you know, we always did, you know, my dad and my uncle and my grandpa would always do like opening day of gun season. And I can't honestly remember like if my dad did any bow hunting before that. I mean, he must have, because he had the bow, right?
Yeah.
But it wasn't really until, I don't know, I probably was like 9, 10, like when I started like to kind of like understand that those guys were going out for opening day of gun, and like I couldn't go. I wasn't old enough. So like in Pennsylvania, you have to be 12 years old to go hunting. And so I was just observing, like they would go, I'd be excited for them to come back. At some point my dad started taking me on some duck and goose hunts. My mom grew up on a farm in Eastern Central Ohio that, her, you know, my grandparents on her side still owned. A lot of it was leased through like base camp leasing. So there was like, we didn't really have access to any of it, but it was there, and there was this lake, and my dad would take me on duck and goose hunts as I was getting older. And so like, you know, I was exposed to it. And then somewhere I started catching on to like the Outdoor Channel, and I could start to watch like Michael Waddell's Bone Collector, and you know, I don't really remember else who else was on at the time, you know, Shockey and, you know, that, that era of guys. And my, you know, just my passion for it started to, my interest, I should say, started to grow. And I was like, you know, I've got all these things around me. I would try to draw my dad's bow back in the basement every once in a while. I think my main influence as far as a, you know, getting into bow hunting whitetail deer, was my uncle. So that's my dad's brother. And, he lived about 2 hours north of us, like I said, in I think it was Crawford County, like Meadville area, Pennsylvania.
Yeah. Yep.
And, he had always been, I mean, he was a diehard, you know, he'd been bow hunting since, whatever, high school, college, had progressed all the way through, you know, killing, the basket racks and, you know, to want to shoot mature deer for that area or bigger, you know, biggest antler deer he could anyways up there. And, in Pennsylvania, spotlighting is legal. I think, I don't think during the season, but, you know, during the summer, I'm not actually sure what the regulation is. We don't do it much anymore, but
just outside, you can't during rifle seasons. So you can still during archery season, as far as I know. Yeah.
Okay. And I know you can't have like a weapon in your car and stuff. And so, but I can remember when we'd go up to visit my grandparents and stuff who lived up there as well. That was like, my uncle would always be like, all right, dude, like let's sneak out and go, and we'll go spotlighting. And that was like my favorite thing in the world to do. Cause you know, I really looked up to my uncle, you know, he was like, you know, who doesn't, you know, my cool uncle. And like, we would sneak away from the dinners that I didn't want to like really be at anyways and go look for deer. Like it was awesome. And I don't even know, how big these deer were, but at the time I was like, there's these giant bucks, like, and it was just like, you know, and, I think that had a really big impact on me wanting to, just in terms of like fueling my interest in deer, especially, not necessarily in bow hunting. Like I didn't really know yet, but I was like, I want to hunt, like when, you know. And so when I turned 12, my dad had bought me a bow. I think I had like a PSE, you know, something or other. I've been going to the same bow shop right here in Holiday Park, Pennsylvania. It's called Ultimate Outdoors. They've been there, I mean, since I was 11, 12 years old. I got my first bow there, and they've set up countless bows for me since. And so Tim and Jason down there, I've fortunate enough to have a good bow shop to go to. That's something everybody should try to find. Yeah. But so Yeah. I mean, dude, that was like, you know, where my interest kind of was sparked. And like my uncle was a big influence with that as well. And like, you know, it's hard to say, so much has changed. I'm 30 years old now. That farm that I mentioned, that my mom had grown up on, the leases have all expired on that. My parents actually, purchased a good portion of that farm, sold the house that I grew up on, and they live out there now. So that's only about 2 hours from me here where I live, just south of Pittsburgh. And I mean, dude, I just don't have any opportunities here in the state that, are better than what we have out there. So every chance that I get, you know, that was kind of, I think they bought that farm from my grandparents like 7 or 8 years ago, maybe more now. And that was like kind of the start of my ability to like operate as a landowner, essentially, even though my parents own that. You know, we started to be able to invest in a piece of property that was like, it's private land. You know, we can run mineral out there. We can plant food plots. We can have trees, you know? And so at that time I started like diving deep down, like the Midwest whitetail. That's when they were picking up, like 2011, 2012. I was all in on like this landowner, like land, manager aspect side of things. And, it's hard to say, you know, now full circle, I've backed off of that a little bit, like with our exposure to like, other opportunities and other states and public land still is a portion of that. And like, so the Ohio farm is a big, big part of my passion today and like where I choose to spend most of my whitetail season. But, like I said, our podcast has given me some perspective on, first of all, how fortunate we are to have that property over there and the opportunities that affords us, but also to, what else is out there.
Yeah. I'd go out and try different things. And no, I think it's so important for people to understand where they're at in their hunting career, if you want to call it that, and like, and what their goals, what they want to do or what they enjoy doing. Like, I know from you, you enjoy chasing big whitetails. Like, you want to hunt big old whitetails, and that's awesome. Like, I don't think, and if Pennsylvania doesn't offer that, then to have enjoyment by going to Ohio and going to Kansas and these other places that you've been to, like, I think that's awesome too.
Yeah. Well, it's not that Pennsylvania doesn't offer that. It's just that, you know, I don't necessarily have the access to do it. And to take a step back, you know, I'll comment on my passion being to hunt these mature bucks. It's interesting how everybody has kind of their own journey, like in that direction. It does seem like for a lot of people, that's kind of where it ends up if they're afforded the opportunities along the way. Not everybody ends up there or necessarily like has to get there. It's not like that's, you know, that's the end of it by any means. But, so I mentioned that my uncle, was a big bow hunter, you know, and he's almost 60 now, you know? And so he had kind of gone through that journey himself, you know, in whatever the 70s, 80s, 90s. I guess even into the early 2000s, you know, he's like, he's been kind of figuring that out for himself. And so him being a primary influence for me, I kind of picked up where he left off. Like, dude, I didn't really have a phase where I was like shooting a bunch of basket rack deer. Like a lot of guys do. A lot of guys have to kill a lot of deer before they decide that they're like, okay, well, I want to start to increase on that. I want to start, you know, bigger, older deer. For whatever reason, dude, I never had that. Like the smallest buck, and this is not like I'm not bragging at all. Like it just is what it is. The smallest deer I've ever shot was like a 2-year-old. It was the first buck I ever shot. It was like a 2-year-old 150 inch, like 8 or 9 point. Which at the time for me was giant buck, you know. It was like late November, this deer come trotting up under my stand. I was like, it was a complete mess in the standing. And it was like, it was one of those things where it was like, I couldn't believe I finally killed, you know, this, I've been hunting for so long. And it probably wasn't until I was, I don't know, 16 or 18 years old. Like I had hunted years before I successfully shot and killed a buck with my bow. I'd killed like a few other does. My first deer I ever shot was like with a 30-30 Marlin, right? And, but so from that 2 year old, I was just like, okay, it's now it's gotta be bigger. And the next one I shot was several years later, you know, and I probably missed some along the way, blue opportunities and stuff. But from there, I killed like a 130-inch 3 year old, and same feeling. I was like, this is the biggest buck I've ever killed. I remember when it came in, I couldn't believe how big its antlers were. I was like, it's just insane. I killed it at 15 yards, you know, just broadside. He wheeled around me 30 yards and crashed over there. And it was like same feeling. I was just elated with that deer. And I just was like, okay, now, you know, and it continued to progress. So like, there never was a time where I was killing like a whole bunch of deer, and there's, you know, in some ways I suffer from that. It's like, I'm not as experienced of a killer as somebody like a Ben Rising, or, you know, somebody that came up through that age where it's like, you know, they were just whacking everything. You know, there's guys who are good at killing. And so I maybe suffer a little bit in that regard, but I just, we talked about this a little bit, you know, even just last week with Allie, is like, you know, we were talking about what kind of deer, and Nick, you know, we're trying to harvest. And dude, the reality that like I've kind of faced is that I don't like killing stuff. You know, it breaks my heart. You know, it's like, I have so much respect for those animals, all animals. That I just like, I can't bring myself to kill an animal that isn't like, you know, isn't to the standard that I've set out for myself. I'm like, man, if I'm going to bring myself to kill an animal, you know, it really needs to be special. It needs to be what I went out there, you know, to do. And so I try to, like, I guess, I don't know, honor the animal in that way, but it also helps me keep my standard. And so like, you know, I don't have 15, 20 bucks on my wall. But I can tell you, I've passed a lot of deer that a lot of people would have shot. And I'm happy to do it. You know, I'd rather that animal have another chance, you know, or even if I know the neighbor's going to kill him, I just, you know, I'm fine with it. It's not an animal that I want to kill.
Yeah. And I think it's important to recognize within yourself if you're able to be okay with that. You know, I think some people tell themselves that they're okay with, you know, passing something and then get mad, you know, if they don't at the end of the year and they don't have something, and like, especially someone that's getting new into hunting, that can be a deterrent from them to keep going, because they don't taste that blood, or they don't feel that success, for lack of better terms. But to be able to do that, but when you have, you know, it sounds like with your mindset, and you were just like determined, like, this is what I'm going to do, and I'm setting these standards and I'm holding to it. And I have a ton of respect for you for being able to do that.
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's not all it's cracked up to be necessarily. I mean, dude, I've eaten a lot of tags, and like, you know, I've blown a lot of opportunities. And it's just, you know, hunting for me is a lot more failure than it is success. I mean, literally, dude, I think, 1, 2, 3, 4, you know, I've maybe killed in my entire career. And again, I'm 30 years old, and I've had some great opportunities to hunt out of state. Like maybe 5 deer over 4 years old. And, you know, the reality is that has been my standard. You know, it's like, I'm not gonna kill something that I don't think is 4 years old or older. And even today, you know, I'm passing some 4 year olds, you know, and I want to see these deer at 5 years old. And, it's totally okay. Like, if people aren't doing that, I just, it just is what it is. You know, I just don't want to kill 3 year old deer and anymore. I'm like, I just don't want to kill 4. I think the end of that, like, I kind of answered it earlier, is like, I just don't want to kill deer unless it's the one.
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that's important to recognize, like you were saying. And what was you guys had done a podcast with somebody, and I apologize, I don't remember the name of the guest, but they were talking about the actual statistics of people that shoot mature deer.
Ryan Fuhrer, yeah.
Yeah, what was that statistic? Because it was really wild to me. Do you remember?
Something like less than 15 or 25% of all deer hunters will ever kill a deer over 125 inches or something like that.
Yeah.
Which I'm not 100% sure if that stat is correct or not, but I mean, sounds right.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is wild, but just showing like how difficult it is to hunt, you know, mature animals and have those opportunities. Like it's hard, you know. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the woods, and now I'm sure different locations and everything's a little bit different, but like I spend a lot of time in the woods to have a couple opportunities a year at something that is a mature animal.
Yeah, it's all relative, right? And so like what you and I think is a lot of time, or what you and I think is like a good area. You know, like the reality is like if you go out to the Midwest during a rifle season, like, you know, if you don't kill 125 inch deer, like your eyes are closed, like they're everywhere. Like it's the easiest thing, you know, it's easy. Not necessarily the case here in Pennsylvania. You know, it's the age structure is just, you know, here in Pennsylvania, there's way more hunters. You know, we have like the second or third highest hunter density in the entire country. The average private land parcel size is, you know, smaller than it would be if you go out to Ohio, or, you know, the further Midwest you go, the bigger tracts of land you get. All that, you know, weighs into age structure and ultimately antler size and opportunity. You know, so in Pennsylvania, that statement's not necessarily true. You know, it might be pretty challenging to go out even with a rifle to kill 125 inch deer. There just aren't as many of them. There's more people out there hunting them. So it's all relative. You know, but you know, I've realized that, and I'm not one of those guys who's like, I just want to kill the best deer I can with what I have. I want to expand what I have. I want to work hard to kill the biggest deer that I can. And if that means, you know, traveling out of state to do it, or, you know, or whatever, like within the bounds of, you know, what I feel is ethical, that's what I'm going to do.
Yeah. Yeah. And yeah, again, that's, I think that's super important for people to understand, because like you look at like a state like Pennsylvania, and if your goal is to shoot 150 inch deer every year, this probably isn't the state that you should try to do that. Are they out there? Yes. But is that where you're going to have your best odds? And this is where like I hate, and I've said it multiple times on the podcast here in the last year, but I absolutely hate when people look at people that have great opportunities from a land perspective or places to go and look down on them because they don't have those opportunities. And because in my opinion, those people work just as hard, if not harder, to get those opportunities. It's just in a different way. It may not be that they scouted 7,000 acres of land to find this buck, but they may had to have worked harder to monetarily be able to do that or to be able to access it. And it's all work in its way, and it depends on what your goals are and how you align that to be able to do it. Like, you know, for example, I primarily hunt public, I hunt some private, I hunt whatever. I'm an opportunist when it comes to being able to do that. But I'd be kidding myself if I didn't tell you that I didn't want to own a big piece of property someday and be able to manage it and hunt deer by doing it in that form. And I think, you know, I don't hold myself on a higher stand, like a pedestal, and be like, oh, because I'm doing it here, then that means that I'm better than this person. That's not it. Like I think each area has its own skills that come involved. And sometimes those skills involve being able to make the money or be able to make the connections to be able to get that access and to be able to do that. And, you know, I talked to Lee Ellis about it multiple times, where it's like, dude, I don't want to do what you do and knock on 200 doors in 2 weeks to try to get access to property and find these big deer. To me, that sucks, and I want nothing to do with that. I would rather walk thousands and thousands of miles and try to figure all this stuff out than have multiple uncomfortable conversations and trying to figure it out that way. Like, that's just the way that I am, and I don't, like, I don't know. That's just, that's something that I'm very passionate about, that like when, depending on people's situations, they've worked to get to that point very rarely. And if someone was given something and they just are able to have it and it just works out, who gives a shit? Like, it is what it is. It's not your situation, so move on.
Yeah, I mean, dude, I don't know. The baseline of that conversation is like, life's not fair. Not everybody has the privilege of owning land, you know, whether you've, you know, worked hard your whole life to buy a piece or, you know, inherited a piece of family ground. Like, it's just, it's all over the board in terms of like who has access to what. And yeah, you can't really blame somebody, for what they have necessarily. It isn't fair in a lot of regards. I mean, there's a lot of guys that maybe are more passionate, are way better hunters, who don't have the access that some people do, right? And there's lots of bad hunters that kill booners every year. It just comes down to access, right? You know, be open-minded to the idea that, like, again, relatively, you know, killing a mature deer is not the hardest thing in the world to do. Like, if you're hunting where they are, and you do it long enough, like, inevitably it will happen. On the other hand, undoubtedly, people that don't have that access, you know, that have to struggle more, you know, on public land, on smaller permission, on, you know, on whatever, and they're being successful in that realm, undoubtedly that person could go to where big deer are and kill them. You know, it's just like training, for something, you know, harder than, overtraining for something, right? Like, so like when I'm training for a mule deer hunt, you know, I've got a frame pack that I put 100 pounds in and I go to, you know, I go to Planet Fitness and I get on a stepper for 25 minutes. I know a mule deer split between two people doesn't weigh 100 pounds. I'm overtraining for it. But the reality is that I train so hard doing that, that when I go and I actually do the mule deer hunt, it's pretty doable. Right. And so the same kind of would apply to, like, if I'm hunting in extreme scenarios of, like, you know, overpressure, you know, little, you know, struggling age structure, you know, whatever it is. And I go out to an area that's like, has abundant opportunity, your chances of success in doing so, relatively easily is pretty good.
Yeah, no, that totally makes sense. I don't know. That's just something that's been on my mind for a while now. And I just hear that stuff and it's just like, I don't understand it. And, you know, like I've even like thought about it from my own perspective. And it's like, you know, like sometimes I get opportunities based off of what now with having, you know, working in the hunting industry and having people that I know that give opportunities to me to be able to go hunt these places. And like, I remember at the beginning, I'd be like, I felt bad about it. Like, oh, not everyone has this. This isn't, you know, but it's like, if I want to do it and I'm just transparent on this is what it is, then why does that matter? Like it shouldn't matter. And,
that's what you're trying to get, right? Like you want to have the best hunting opportunities possible.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's weird, you know, because everybody wants to, I don't know. I think people want to justify, just being content with what they have, which, you know, there's nothing wrong with that. In terms of like, you know, hunting where you have to hunt or hunting with the time that you have to hunt, but you also can't get mad at somebody for sacrificing for more. You know, and so like, I think it's interesting. You bring up like the land ownership, like everybody would like to own land and, you know, or hunt on private land. And it's like, yeah, dude, I take that approach as well. Like, and maybe to an extreme, like to a fault, but it's like, dude, I'm not just okay. You know, I'm trying to think of what I have here. You know, there's public in Pennsylvania, like what my opportunities would be otherwise. I'm not just okay with that. Like I'm not okay with just like the opportunities that I have. And so I mean, in almost every avenue of my life, you know, finances, like the careers that I've chosen, like, I've done so with my desire to bow hunt giant whitetail deer, in the back, or in some cases in the forefront of my mind. I'm like, listen, I need to produce X amount of money. I need to have X amount of free time during, you know, the fall season to be able to do these things. And, you know, that's the sacrifice that, like, dude, 99% of people like won't make. And it doesn't necessarily mean that I'm going to kill bigger deer than everybody else, because everybody has different circumstances, but I'm going to give myself the best chance that I can.
Yeah. Yeah. I was talking to Johnny Stewart about that, which I know, you know, Johnny, you know, and like, yeah, you know, I've talked about it with him on here about like the sacrifices that, you know, he makes and decided, like, with his business that he's going to take off for 3 or 4 months when he can make a lot more money and be in a better place. But his goal is like, he wants to chase whitetails. And well, like, that's what every, like, the people that I see, some of the most successful ones, like, they're sacrificing a lot to be able to do that. And that's not everybody's willing to do that. And that's the nature of the beast. Like, we all have the same amount of time in a day, you know, to be able to do things. It's like, what are you willing to give up to get? And just looking at a very, very black and white.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, dude, everybody wants to shoot the big buck. You know, but when you start looking at what these guys are doing, who are doing it, it's like how much money goes into it, how much sacrifice of time, like whether it's with family or, I mean, dude, if you get right down to it, right? Like, so I'm 30 years old and my wife's 30 years old too. My parents are asking us all the time, like, when are you guys having kids, you know, it's always coming up. And like, I don't know, man, like, I'm not going to say that, like, I'm not having kids because I want to hunt big deer, but like, certainly, it's a factor. Like, it's in my mind there. It's like, man, if I have to sacrifice that time for kids, it's like, you know, and it's to that extreme level of thinking that it's like, you know, you just, it is what it is. You know, that's the reality of, like, if you have kids, a lot of people that I know that have kids, don't get nearly the time that I do to hunt. And I'm not saying at all they made the wrong decision or I made the right decision. It just is what it is. And that's maybe not forever either. You know, our minds could change here in the next couple of years, or, you know, circumstances could change, but like for right now, it's killing big deer is at the top of the priority.
Yeah. And unapologetically so, like, I don't think anybody should feel bad about like what their, you know, goals are or what they want to do and understand, like, but you just have to understand the consequences that come with that. And that's the nature of it. I mean, I'm, you know, in that boat now with me wanting to, you know, go and do this thing and have my own businesses and be able to be financially free and do this stuff. Like, okay, yeah, I learned that it was going to take me longer than probably everybody else in the typical timeline to have a beautiful house and be able to do, like, you know, the traditional things in that timeline.
Houses,
like,
are overrated, dude.
Yeah. Are you married? I'm not.
You don't need a house.
Yeah. And so it's like, I was like, oh, I'd rather have a smaller house and a little bit of land and like, and then be able to do some other things. And yeah, is that selfish from looking at it that way? Yeah, probably it is, but it's also my life and the way that I want to make the most of it. And I've just seen so many people that decide that they're doing something based on what others want them to do, and that feel like they have to impress somebody of doing a certain thing. And again, I don't think either of us are saying that the traditional path of going down things is wrong. And a lot of people are very happy in that. It's just like, I know for myself that I wanted something different, and I wouldn't be happy doing things the same way as everybody else. And that's, and I think that's important to recognize within people, but it's like, it takes a lot of sacrifice. Like, there's a lot of things that I don't have because of the things that I do have.
Yeah. Well, dude, count yourself lucky you're one of, you know, just a small fraction of people who know what they want. I think it's like, it's weird to think about because it's so second nature. Hunting is in my blood. Like, you know, everything that I do is like, I was built for it. There are so many people out there who don't know what they want out of life. They don't know like what they want to do. Like there's, I don't know, for whatever reason, they just never figured out what they like, or like they just didn't decide to pursue it when they did figure it out. And, you know, those people end up just like, I don't know, you know, going the through the motions in life, right? Like, you know, and I don't know. I mean, you know, I have to be careful because people have responsibilities, you know, and you know, kids are a big one. I can understand, like, dude, if you're responsible for other human life, like, that better be your priority over hunting.
Yeah. Yeah. 100%.
Yeah. But I mean, for me right now, like, dude, I feel so fortunate, and I think you do too, to know what I love to do. And it's like, to the point where I just have this feeling where it's like, dude, if you're not bow hunting deer, like, what are you doing? Is like kind of how I feel about it. And I realize other people have other passions, and that's great. Cause like, you know, not everybody can be a bow hunter, and, you know, there's not enough room in the woods, right? It wouldn't work. But I certainly feel fortunate to have discovered what I love to do early on, and to have the opportunities along the way to pursue it wholeheartedly.
Yeah. And I think I should also put a little bit of an asterisk to what I said about some things. Cause like, if someone does, like you said, if someone has kids or they're doing that, like, I think that's amazing. And I think that 100% has to be the priority. That's someone else's life.
100%.
That not like that trumps deer hunting at that point. It's like, but you know, when you're at that decision point on whether you want to go that route or not, you have to be honest with yourself and understand that there's going to be giving up some time.
That's a real thing, dude. I don't think a lot of people like really will come out and have that conversation openly, but it's like, and it doesn't have to be one or the other. I mean, there's lots of people with kids that deer hunt. Are you going to sacrifice for a period of time, you know, your ability to deer hunt to do that? Yeah, you absolutely you are. You better be, right? So that you can be a good parent. You know, they deserve that. So,
yeah, most definitely. And I always like when we talk about these things, like, I try to, you know, I want to make sure that I talk about like the where I'm at and how I'm doing things, but like also put that caveat on there. That's like, okay, that's not for everybody. And I'm also not demeaning anybody that chooses a different route. I just think that the whole point of this conversation is like, you have to be honest with yourself and what you want. And based off of the things that you have and what you're able to create, like, what do you want to do and how bad do you want it? And that's up to you to be able to kind of make those shifts.
Yeah, it's your life, dude.
Like,
make your decisions.
There was a guy that came to our scouting camp that I hosted, and you know, he was saying like, and he was like, this guy, I love this guy. He was asking a ton of questions, and he's like, listen, I don't have a lot of time, got kids, have all this stuff. I want to learn to be efficient with this time. And that's what, you know, he was happy to be able to do. And, you know, he, you know, was more towards certain people in the group that had limited time that were talking, like, that's where he gravitated towards. And that's awesome. Like, you know, owning that, like, this is my situation, I'm going to make the best of that situation and be able to do that. And that's, I think that's important too. Like, wasn't looking at me or you and be like, oh, those guys, just the only reason they do that is because they have so much time. It's like, wasn't saying that. It was just like, okay, this is what I have available, let me make the most of it.
Yeah. Well, and dude, I have a ton of respect for that. Like, guys that have those kind of commitments. I mean, guys that work 9 to 5s, like, you know, not everybody is like, you know, has the opportunity, the ability, or should, you know, structure their entire life around like deer hunting. That probably shouldn't happen. I've got a ton of respect for people that, whether they chose it or, I mean, do people find themselves in circumstances? Like, not everyone was born into the same, you know, financial, you know, property access, like, you know, all these things. Like, everybody's dealt a different card of hands. And like, to the point about kids, is like, dude, not everybody makes a conscious decision. They're like, okay, now we're gonna have kids. Like, it just happens sometimes, and that could happen to us. And like, you know, we have to be open-minded to that. But my point being is, I've got a lot of respect for guys who are like handling their responsibility and still finding time to get out in the woods and to be successful with it. I mean, it's admirable.
Yeah, it totally is. And yeah, owning it, like, okay, this is what happened, this is my situation, whether I wanted that or if I didn't, and owning it and being like, what can I make the best out of that particular situation? And yeah. I think that's it's a really good point to be able to go off of there. But I don't know, man, I just I'd almost I do feel bad for people that don't have the passions about things, like going back, like I think hunters all have passions, but like
sad. Like,
dude, I'm ate up by it like all the time, just thinking about deer and different hunts. And like, I have a very serious like drive to want to do adventure hunts all over, like going to Alaska this year, I'm hunting moose. And like that's, I have like this other side of me that just wants to go to crazy places and experience it. And if you had asked me 10 years ago, I never would have thought that was possible until I like opened my mind to it. It was like, all right, I'm going to need to get a lot of things in a line to make this happen. I'm not sitting here with an endless bank account or being able to do these things, but like, if I want to make that a priority, I'm going to have to do that and figure it out. And, you know, I've been very blessed to be able to figure some of that out. I'm not saying I have it figured out, but to figure some of it out to be able to have these opportunities.
Yeah. Yeah. You make it happen, dude. I mean, I don't know. You just make it happen.
Yeah, no, 100%, dude. Well, I know you have to run. You have a haircut appointment coming up. So.
No, I don't. It's canceled.
Oh, you don't? Oh, you don't.
I'm good.
Okay.
Dude.
Well, okay. Well, there's one. Okay,
speaking of kids, my barber had her kid this past weekend. So, I mean, she canceled it.
Honestly, I should be the one that's probably going to get a haircut right now. But
you've seen my dude. Mine was longer than yours a couple weeks ago.
I know. You got yours all cut off, and now you're going back again. I'm about at that point. It's getting warm out. Like, so it's funny about the hair thing is like every like 1 to 2 years I grow my hair out long, and I usually do it during hunting season. And I used to make it a thing where I wouldn't cut my hair until I killed a buck. And that was always like my thing. And I'd like start in the summer, and sometimes it'd get longer than others because of how long it would take. But I always had this like weird fear of, they always say like you go bald based off of your mom's father's, like that side of the family. Right. And like my grandpa and my uncles on that side, they're kind of bald on the top there. And my hairline like receded for a little while. And I was like really
let me see. I'll tell you where you're at. Yeah, you're doing pretty good. Yeah, you're doing pretty good. Dude, mine came from my dad's side. My hairline looked exactly like my uncle on my dad's side. To a T.
Really?
Yeah, you're coming back here.
Yeah. And it's funny because, but anyways, I'm like, I'm going to go bald at some point. It was like, I've had this in my mind forever.
Yeah, you just got to deal with it.
I'm like, I'm just going to grow my hair while I can, you know, have this long, you know, thing. And then I'm realizing like maybe I'm not actually, because my dad just like his like recedes up like a widow's peak, and then like he's got a full head of hair on top. So I'm like, maybe that's just the route that I'm going. So I don't know, but that's what started with it. I haven't had a haircut since last July, not even a trim. I mean, just full out, let it go, from the point where it was like shaved on the sides and to where it is now. So it's getting pretty
that long in 1 year.
Yeah
That was a lot.
Yeah.
I cut, mine was buzzed. I had long hair like in high school, and then, I cut it when going into college. For a long time there, I had it like it is now. And then, all the way through when I got married, and then it was when COVID hit. I was just like, for whatever reason, I was just like, I'm just not going to cut my hair. And, cause we were all like in the Hobbit phase. And then, so I didn't cut. So that was 2020. You know, 2020, 21, 22. So yeah, two and a half, 3 years, I guess. And it got long. I mean, mine was like, you know, and I got it cut a few times, but yeah, dude, I had way too much party in the back and not enough business in the front. And I had less and less business in the front by the day. So eventually I was just like, dude, let's just take it off, you know? And honestly, it was inconvenient to like, you know, I don't know. And it's minor, but I mean like carrying, it's like a scent wick going in the woods, you know, it's like, there's always grease in your hair and stuff. And I was like, yeah, as cool as it looks hanging out of the back of my beanie, like I should be a little more scent conscious. And then also, you know, with our meetings with real estate clients and stuff is, you know, I try to look at least a little bit professional with as little effort as possible. So, you know, short hair was the way to go for the time being.
I've been like running into people that I haven't seen in a while, like in my hometown, and they'll be like, oh, like, oh, I didn't recognize you. Like, oh, like kind of looking at me like, oh, he let himself go. Like he's, he's in trouble. He quit his job. And, that could be it.
Yeah.
I haven't shaved my mustache in 5 years. Yeah.
I've never had the strong, facial hair, genes. It just doesn't work for me.
Well, the reason why I did that is cause I couldn't grow a beard and all I could do was a goatee and it just looked real trashy when I had that. And I'd always just have the mustache during the rut and I called it the rut stash, like well before I had the podcast and everything, like since I was out of college, it'd be like a little pencil stash and like a little darker and a little better. Dude, and
what is that? That's a thing. Like I don't know what it is, but when deer season starts getting close, I just feel a desire to grow a mustache. Like even though I can't grow a good one, I'm like, it just seems like the thing to do, doesn't it?
Yeah. I don't know. When I've been looking into it in the statistics, it increases your success by 37.2%. I mean, it's fact. What it does. See,
no, you're using the same approach as like the moon guide. Is if you only hunt when there's a red moon, then you're only going to kill bucks when there's a red moon. It's the same principle.
I don't know, man. I
feel it too. Believe me, I do want to grow it up, but I think it has more to do just with like, just getting to your roots of manliness. You just want to participate in like, the deer camp, traditions.
Yeah. Okay. Whatever. We'll agree to disagree there. I think it's science, but whatever. So last thing I wanted to ask you about was you had an experience of getting to hunt some big wood stuff last year, with Steve Shirk, a mutual friend of ours. And I just wanted to hear like what your thoughts were on hunting big woods like that, or if you had in the past, and if what that experience was like.
Yeah. So it was tough, man. We hunted, I don't know exactly where Steve's camp is at, but yeah, up north, you know, big woods. Do you know?
Yeah. I mean, he's up towards the New York border.
The New York border. And definitely a lot different than I'm used to hunting. So, I mean, you probably, I don't know, 60-80% of my deer hunting happens at our farm in Ohio. And just for context, it's transition ground. You know, it's like, it's between big ag pasture ground and what you would call, you know, big woods for Ohio, which is different than big woods in Pennsylvania. Like in Ohio, it's like oak ridges, flats. I don't know. Like a lot more, I don't know, more terrain. It's just different. In Pennsylvania, it was like the true feeling of like, I don't know, felt empty, like empty giant woods and not nearly as much wildlife in it. Maybe is the way to describe. And this is just, you know, limited experience. So like, you know, obviously there's more, you know, you could correct me here when I'm wrong, but so we were stoked, you know, it was October like 18th. It's like right in like what should have been that sweet spot. And we hit that, a cold front, like it couldn't have been any better. Like I remember going up there, I was like, dude, we're going to crush them. You know, all of Steve's cameras are on, scrapes. And like we had this big rain front come through and temps were dropping like 30 degrees. And it was like, I couldn't have set the stage, I don't think, any better. At least from like, you know, a textbook, like, you know, scrape hunts. And we had like three or four days to hunt, I think, 3 or 4 days. And we actually went up a day early to catch that front right on it. So like the first time we got in a stand was like front head passed overnight the night before, temps dropped the whole morning. We were in it. We were in that high pressure, you know, bluebird day. Like they should have been crushing those scrapes within hours of us getting there. And so we drove up there. Jeremy and I and Jeremy's dad came with us, and there was like four or five other guys in camp. Got to camp. We went straight to the stands that night. We went straight to the stands. So Steve kind of sent us some pins, like different areas he'd been checking out. His outfit is kind of like, he will hang stands for people, but I think he's trying to bring in more hunters who are able to like hang their own stands, like run a gun. It's just, you know, he covers so much ground with cameras and stuff that it would be really difficult for him to drive an hour in one direction and hang a stand, go 45 minutes in another direction. So, I mean, he's trying to, I think, bring in more guys that are more self-sufficient. So we went out, I did just kind of a little bit of scouting on my way in. I ended up finding the camera that he dropped a pin for me. And I just determined that, you know, that seemed like the best spot for the stand too. There wasn't anywhere really that had better sign or anything. So hunted it that night with high hopes, as did Jeremy and his dad and everybody else that had gotten to their stand. And, just didn't happen that night. So I decided to leave the stand. I didn't see anything that night. No deer. Left my stand in the tree that night, decided I was going to go back in that's, I love to do that. I hate hanging stands in the morning. So if I ever have the opportunity to leave a stand overnight, I leave everything. I leave my bow in the stand, everything. I climb up in a stand, I sit down, I'm hunting. As mobile as I am, I really prefer that. I mean, that's nice. I was hunting a big deer. I mean, he was like an 8-year-old buck. That Steve have all this history with. He was probably, you know, 145 inch type deer. I would have been elated to shoot him, you know, just knowing how hard it is to kill an old buck in Pennsylvania and stuff. And so I was hunting this deer, and I was way out of camp. I was driving an hour like every direction. And so I went back the next morning. Same deal. Didn't see a deer. And I just was like wanting to familiarize myself, I think, with the area. I was like, well, I don't know, like maybe I'm missing something here. I'm going to get out and scout the area. So I think I put on like 10 miles that day. I got down at like, I don't know, 9:30, 10 o'clock. And I was looking at everything on our maps ahead of time. I was like, I know where we need to look here. And I mean, dude, I walked 10 miles and didn't find anything better than where I was at. I just walked all that and ended up right back in there. And, we hunted the next 2-3 days. I bounced around a little bit. There was like one or two other spots that I tried, but, I could be wrong about this. I don't think anybody saw a deer from the stand that week. And it was funny, like as that was unfolding, I was just kind of like realizing maybe my expectations were too high. I'm used to seeing, you know, deer ever when I hunt, I guess, you know, and, our sightings were far and few between. I think there was something happening at that time. Just like, you know, a lot of guys in that area were running cameras and stuff, and there just wasn't a lot of activity. They just didn't fire up from that front like we thought that they would. And in my opinions, they didn't come out of, you know, the clear cuts or wherever they were at. There was no need. There's no acorns that year. It was like a really terrible acorn crop. They're checking scrapes, you know, getting into that time of year, but there's no need to do that until after dark. So I just think that the deer I was hunting was in a clear cut, and he never came out.
Yeah. And what's funny is Steve and I did a podcast talking about our cameras, and we both, me, him, and my dad all did like pulled all the data from those cameras and looked at it and the different dates. And I was like, so set when you were coming up and I was texting you, I'm like, you're going to hit it perfect. Like I would have bet all the money on it that you would have had a dynamite hunt. And
they were, I mean, I had confirmation. So like my farm in Ohio, I've got like, you know, 15, 20 cameras running on it. And sure enough, bam, 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 you know, they're firing off. And I'm like, well, we're here. So
yeah. Well, but I had similar like camera intel from those days. And even, I think I even hunted a day or those two of that where not a single deer. And it was just like, you know, sometimes you have those outliers in areas that just didn't work out. And this past year, honestly, was a year that was the worst from a sign perspective that I've had in the last 5-6 years. It was really difficult, and it was just took a different kind of approach to it. And you know, it was a dry year, a lot of food was different. You know, I think it changed bedding up because things like browned up quicker and leaves fell off, and it's just like it was different. That's all there is to it. But it's definitely not atypical to sit 3 or 4 days without seeing a single deer. I mean, when I killed my buck this year, November 4th, for 3 or 4 days leading up to that, I never saw a single deer. That was the first deer that I saw. Just happened to be a 4-year-old 8-point that I ended up shooting. And that's kind of the nature of it. And it's so hard to, I grew up with it like that. So I just kind of like became used to it. But yeah, it's very difficult when you come from an area where there's higher deer densities or even have the visibility to be able to see them, even if you're not great in the game.
Well, I think it has to do with, and maybe you said that first, deer density.
Yeah.
Yeah. It's just like, it's hard to describe. And I don't know if this is like the right comparison for it, but it's like, dude, when I'm hunting like farm country, you know, like I mentioned, our farm is a lot of like small brushy pockets, you know, and like hogbacks and field edges. And it's kind of like, you know, trout fishing a small stocked stream. It's like, you know where they're at. Like, you know, it's like, yeah. It's not really a mystery. It's like, you know, you use the terrain and it's like, you're going to get eyes on them at least. You might not kill them, but you know, you can figure them out. You know, hunting the big woods to me was kind of like fishing a lake where it's like, and I don't have a radar. I don't have like the ability to see what terrain is down there even. It's just kind of like, you know, you obviously still are using terrain features and there's principles that apply, but it's like on a way bigger scale. It's like, mm-hmm. Maybe another way to say that is like at my farm, everywhere there is habitat, there are deer and you just have to figure out how to hunt them. Everywhere there's habitat in the big woods, it's like, there's probably still not deer there, you know, that, at least like as frequently, you know, they're very, you know, they're very like, they're where they're at and they're not where they're not. And that's different.
Yeah, no, definitely is. Well, I hope you give it another chance sometime because it would be cool for you to see, because sometimes, you know, when things do hit right, it can be really awesome. And like, it makes those like days without deer just magical. Like, you know, there'll be days during the rut where, you know, go days without seeing a deer and all of a sudden one hot doe comes through and then there's the only 7 bucks in the county come running through. And it's just like, you know, things like that happen. And it's just such a different scenario. Like even me now hunting a lot in southern West Virginia and hunting some of that mountain country, but it's like big woods mixed with some coal country. So there's some like openness to it and everything, but there's the deer density is so much higher in the specific spot that I hunt. And it's like, it's freaking awesome. Like I love seeing deer. I'm like, holy cow. I feel like I'm actually in the game.
Be careful. Cause you'll never want to go back.
Yeah, I know. I gotta be careful of that for sure. But
have you ever hunted bow in like any farm country stuff or, you know, getting towards the Midwest?
Yeah, I've, so I used to have a small lease in Ohio that was like 50 acres at some point. Let me think, like near Canton, Ohio.
Okay.
So
like,
yeah.
Like northeastern kind of? Is that right?
Yeah, northeastern kind of. And yeah, it was just like had a couple ag fields in there and some terrain and some timber. And it was like, it was, but it was also, it's funny when you're talking about baiting. I remember that, like, that was the first time I thought that I just put up a feeder and then you just sit over it and you shoot a deer. And that's just how baiting worked. I thought that mm-hmm. was not the case. So I hunted there and I killed a couple bucks off of that piece during the rut. It was like, there was an old strip like pond where it was like almost like a straight wall that went down. And then there was like 40 yards between the field and that straight wall. And it was like the deer have to travel through here at some point and just sitting there. And that's where I had success. And then, I hunted Illinois early season last year, with an outfitter and so that was some farm country, but honestly, and then in college, I went to college in Slippery Rock and I hunted some public areas and some private that had permission that were farm country. And I'd killed a 2-year-old buck off of one of those pieces, but that was really about it as far as my experience in farm country.
Nice. I've got some farms for sale in Slippery Rock right now, if you're looking.
Do you? Oh, I love that area.
It's a nice area. Yeah, I mean, dude, if I can say anything about in support of like Big Woods or, you know, public land in general over, you know, private land or farmland, is like, man, if you don't have a lot of access, you know, on the farmland side of things, it you know, maybe it can feel really restrictive. Like, I can imagine if I only had like a 40 acre field with a tree line to hunt, like I know what that feels like. And if I had to choose between that and like the freedom to explore, you know, public land or even in a big wood setting, it's like, I could definitely understand where the appeal to hunt a big wood setting for guys that maybe don't have a lot of private land access would come from. I mean, it essentially affords you the freedom and flexibility to find them.
Yeah. And that's what I love the most about it, is just like, there's no restriction. Like, to find the deer, I have the ability to do that. I just have to, you know, walk and go do that and find them and spread cameras out and do it. And like, maybe because I've always had that open to me, when I go to areas of small pieces, I just feel like anxiety almost, that like,
I get it.
I'm not in control unless you're able to actually manage it. But like, I feel like I'm not in control of like that piece that I had in Ohio. It was great during the rut because people were passing, the deer were passing through to go to the other farms where we're talking to the neighbors. They were dumping out like literally like truckloads of corn every day. And it was like the deer seemed to be there. They just, in the early season, late season, the food wasn't great on the property that I had access to, and it wasn't even really worth hunting. But during the rut, they'd pass through there and it was great, you know? So it was like, but that was like super frustrating for me, of like, I can't just go try to find them where they are at this time of year. And that's not easy with those small pieces.
Maybe it's a better analogy than I thought, but like, go back to my, you know, trout fishing a small stream versus the lake. It's like, yeah, dude, if you just go tromping through like the trout stream and push all the trout out of their like little pockets, they ain't going to be there. Like, you're not going to have any luck, you know. But if you're throwing the wrong lure out in a lake, you know, or whatever, like driving across it with a boat, it's not necessarily going to mess you up as bad, because like, they're used to it. It's a bigger environment. Like, your presence is having less of an impact, you know, in some regards.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's definitely interesting, dude. I think it's a great option for, you know, somebody looking to stretch their legs and, you know, figure a deer out in a big setting like that. I mean, it definitely gives you the freedom to do it.
Yeah, no, that's exactly right. And I like the analogy with the trout stream. That's kind of funny, because the one thing I always think about with like public land where you have a big area, and then private land, like, I feel like I can be more aggressive on public land, especially if I'm not hunting a specific deer. Is like, okay, you blow them out, you blow out an area, whatever, you move on to the next, and you have five spots that you can go to, where, okay, if you only have a couple locations where you can hunt on a piece of property, you probably got to be a little bit more careful on some of that stuff, because you could screw it up for the, you know, the entire year or whatever.
No doubt. No, I think it's a different approach. I mean, I think you should be aggressive on public land. I mean, it's kind of a race against, you know, other guys and, you know, whatever, the pressure is kind of on. Whereas like on a private land setting, or if you have a small acreage that only hunts certain times of the year, you know, you should really be way more strategic with your, or limited, I should say, in your, you know, when you're actually hunting. You know, that's where you hear the guys who are like, well, you know, killing the first time in, or, cause you know, you not only have the time and the ability to sit back and watch to be able to do that, you know, but you also kind of have to, cause if you go in and pressure them off, you know, you're going to blow your one and only opportunity or whatever it is.
Yeah. And two, like, the one thing that, my dad brought up, and it really like hit home when he said this, but he's like, all the deer, you know, on public ground, like, even though you're not putting pressure on them and you're waiting for the perfect time to strike and do this, how many other bird hunters are in there, people walking through the woods, or other hunters that are like kind of going through? And that's why, in my opinion, I do think that those deer will tolerate a little bit more pressure sometimes, and they just find good hiding spots and good bedding areas that allow them to slip out before they get, you know, in trouble. So like, when I bump a deer, that's not the end of the world to me, where, you know, I learned this when I was up in Alberta, which was, I guess that was farm country when I hunted up there. But Jim, the outfitter was like, hey, you know, these deer don't have any pressure at all. So if they do get disturbed, they're freaked out. Like, they're gone. Like, they just, you know, freak out. And, you know, that's his opinion. But it's interesting when you look at deer and the environments and try to understand how, you know, they tolerate the pressure and how they'll kind of move towards it. And it's very area specific, in my opinion.
Yeah, no doubt. No doubt. But it was certainly a contrast to what I'm used to. Can I say it'd be my first choice? Not necessarily, but I can understand. I could see myself back there at some point.
All right. That's fair enough, man. well, Jared, I think we'll wrap this one up here. If you want to tell everybody where they can follow along, check out your guys' podcast and your whitetail property stuff, whatever you feel like throwing out there.
Yeah, sure. You just check out our podcast. It's most of the handles, I think, are We Are Hunter or Hunter Podcast. And that's it. If you're in southwestern Pennsylvania, you're interested in looking at some land, you can check us out at whitetailproperties.com, or you can email me directly. It's Jared Prussia. It's JARED.Prussia, PRUSIA, at whitetailproperties.com. I'd be happy to help you out.
Awesome. Well, thank you for coming on, dude. It was a good conversation. I enjoyed just talking about a variety of things and just kind of shooting the shit.
Yeah, buddy. It's a lot of fun. I appreciate you having me on.
Thanks, man.
All right. See ya.
Thanks so much for listening to this episode of East Meets West Hunt with your host, Bo Martonic. For more great content and to stay up to date, visit eastmeetswesthunt.com, Facebook at East Meets West Outdoors, and Instagram at East Meets West Hunt. If you enjoyed today's episode, please review and subscribe, and we'll catch you next time.